From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, and prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, we put Hollywood on the couch with writer-turned-therapist Dennis Palumbo. But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Go nowhere, it's The Business from NPR. If you're wondering what just happened with the actors' contract negotiations, here's what happened with the actors' contract negotiations. 2 weeks ago, the producers basically told the Screen Actors Guild, by even asking for more money on DVDs, you proved to us that you're not serious about negotiating. Which, of course, would be exactly the very thing which anybody who was serious about negotiations would be asking for. So, how did SAG respond? They immediately fired back with a mealy-mouthed statement. It said they were willing to give ground on the one demand they said they would never give ground on, DVDs. And what producers thought when they heard that was, they're afraid to strike. And so now the studios will have a go at AFTRA, who will, no doubt, promptly roll over and make exactly the same deal as the writers and directors, leaving its frenemy, SAG, twisting in the wind. At some point, the producers will certainly come back to SAG and say, you can take that wimpy deal we offered AFTRA, or you can go on strike, which we know you're not going to do anyway, and then crawl back to make an even wimpier deal. Separately, the six major Hollywood studios won a major $111 million judgment last week for copyright infringement against the defunct file-sharing site TorrentSpy. Now, for those of you keeping score, that means that the MPAA won $30,000 per violation for nearly 3,700 illegal movie and TV show downloads. The site's operators, Valence Media, permanently closed down on March 24th, posting a final message that said, the legal climate in the USA for copyright is simply too hostile. You think? Meanwhile, actor Robert Redford offered proof last week that all Hollywood rumors are true. Eventually. In June 2004, a Fortune magazine report asked, will Redford's money woes force a sale of his Sundance channel? The answer was yes, but just not right away. Last week, 4 years later, Cablevision's Rainbow Holdings bought the Sundance Channel for $496 million. Redford will get nearly $35 million for his 7% share of the company. While that's good news for Robert Redford, it's bad news for the indie film community, because Cablevision's Rainbow Holdings also owns the Independent Film Channel, or IFC. It's an open question whether it will keep the two channels or simply smush them into one. Finally, we must note with alarm that fully 9 of last Thursday's 23-page edition of Daily Variety consisted of special reports about the Daytime Emmys or ads congratulating the winners of Daytime Emmys. And here we'd like to say well done to the Oprah Winfrey Show for its win in the category of electronic camera video control. Now, look, we get it. Variety's got to pay some bills. But where's the news about scripts being sold, projects being greenlit, movies being cast? There isn't any. After a $2 billion 100-day writer's strike, the studios are spooked and the networks are retrenching. Bracing for an actor's strike, nothing is moving ahead that can't be finished by June 30th, when the actor's contract expires, and certainly nothing's being developed. And what does the town do when that happens? Does it look inward, examining the unique confluence of market forces and labor strife? Of course not! They fire their agents! Variety's Michael Fleming recently wrote a front-page story cataloging the agency defections of no fewer than 10 of the biggest screenwriters in the business in the last couple of weeks. The whole town, writers, agents, executives, is in need of therapy, which is a fabulous segue for our next segment with screenwriter-turned-therapist Dennis Palumbo. Dennis Palumbo worked as a screenwriter in Hollywood for 15 years, with feature film credits like My Favorite Year and TV shows like Welcome Back, Kotter. But like so many writers, he was in therapy, and at some point realized he liked the process of therapy better than the business of show business. He went back to school, and in the nearly 2 decades since, he's been treating Hollywood creative types for their very special brand of neuroses. He's also managed to break away from his busy practice to keep doing some writing of his own. His new book of whodunits is called From Crime to Crime, Mind-boggling tales of mystery and murder. Welcome to The Business.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
You say that it's the same everywhere, therapy.
Yes.
Except here.
Here, where it's different.
Where it's different. What do you mean?
What I mean is that the issues that I see with my patients, you know, anxiety, depression, relationship issues, are the same as everyone else has, except for the fact that in the Hollywood community, first of all, for a creative person, these issues are tremendously important because if you're a writer or a director or an actor, you're so affected by this material. You can be having an argument with your wife, and if you're a bricklayer, you can still lay bricks. But if you're a screenwriter or an actor, the raw materials of your work is your personal life. And so it's really wrapped up in it. And secondly, this is a public arena if you're an actor or a writer or a director. So the pressure of the spotlight enhances all of your career issues. You know, if you're a lawyer and you don't have as many cases this year as you did last year, that's one thing. If you're a TV writer and you're not on a show this year and you were on one last year, everyone in Hollywood knows it. And so there's a kind of public exposure to all the same pressures everyone else has in terms of occupation and relationships. But the prism can be very public and the stakes can be very big.
I think there is a widespread conception, maybe misconception, mm-hmm. that writers are the most miserable people. That, you know, directors are all autocrats, writers are all misanthropes, and actors are all narcissists. Is that – are the clichés true?
Well, in a certain way they are, but only really, really broadly. I mean, a writer friend of mine once described writers as egomaniacs with low self-esteem, and that's a pretty good description. I think on the whole, particularly in Hollywood and particularly in screenwriting, screenwriters are probably the most frustrated and angry because they have the least control compared to how important their contribution is.
What's the single biggest issue with writers?
Okay. The biggest single issue I would say probably is fear of failure, mm-hmm. a concern that if they don't succeed, their fears and doubts about how talented they are will be confirmed. You know, it's funny. Everyone makes fun of Sally Field when she got up and got her Oscar and said, "You like me. You really like me." But I thought it was the only honest Oscar acceptance speech I'd ever heard, because most people, particularly writers, but most people who come to Hollywood are in search of an approving parent. And it's the worst place in the world to find one. And I think that's why writers in particular turn their agents or their managers or the studio or their producers into parent figures. And their writing is a way to get approval.
Is that why we see so many people choke after winning an Oscar? That is, having finally gotten that success, it's supposed to scratch the itch and it doesn't? Is that it?
Well, I think
so. Why do so many people succeed at the highest level and then
– Well, I think there's a couple things. It's, first of all, I think the smart writer, the smart creative person understands that awards are nice and that kind of validation is nice. But the next day you still have to sit at the keyboard and sweat. There is no place you get to where you're done.
Except in Hollywood, that it's not really the case. I mean, James Cameron won the Oscar for Titanic,
right.
And he never made – he's making a movie now, mm-hmm. finally, but at Fox. But 10 years went by.
Well, it's true. There's a number of reasons that happens. Number one, once you've won an Oscar, in my experience, in my practice with both writers and directors, once you've won an Oscar, there's a tremendous pressure that your next project be great. And so you'll often spend a year or two developing a script or a project and go, nope, this isn't great enough. And then you'll do another one. Conversely, a lot of my Oscar-winning screenwriter patients, after winning the Oscar, the very next job they have, the producer or studio invariably is disappointed with the script they hand in. Sort of like, oh, he got an Oscar last year, but this one doesn't seem Oscar caliber to us. The expectation game, the bar gets raised so high that you begin to fear that the worst thing that ever happened to you was winning the Oscar. I had a number of patients in my practice who told me that being nominated was great, but winning was a curse. So that the expectations were you were an Oscar-nominated writer or director, but you weren't under any obligation to deliver the goods at that same level again.
It's interesting because I hear that a lot from executives on the other side,
mm-hmm.
the business side. The best job they ever had was executive vice president.
That's right.
They had all the power. They had all the prestige, or most of it, but without being the chief, without having the head on the chopping block on every single decision. That once you ascend to the throne, you know.
Yeah, there's only one place to go, you know, is down. And so I think that's why for many, many creative people, the process of the journey is better than the reward that they think will make them feel so good. I mean, what I often tell my writers is enjoy the process of writing, the day-to-dayness of being a writer, because those peaks when they come will not answer those deep psychological yearnings that you have. It's only growing in a kind of sense of craft and mastery that makes you feel really good as a creative person.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Dennis Palumbo. He's a former Hollywood screenwriter who's been a therapist in Hollywood for the last 19 years. And he's also written a new book, From Crime to Crime, Mind-Boggling Tales of Mystery and Murder. Directors, what is the biggest issue with these guys?
Oh, the biggest issue with directors is simple, is their vision going to be realized? Everything they make, they feel, is going to be looked at by all the film critics of the world and put in a kind of list, in a hierarchy. You know, so Orson Welles and Truffaut and Kurosawa is up here. And then down here is the guy that made, you know, Hey Dude, Where's My Car? And every director wants to be Stanley Kubrick and Orson Welles. They really want to aim for the bleachers, like every baseball player wants to be Babe Ruth.
But it almost sounds like that sets you up for another kind of problem as a director, which is you're talking about in the entire pantheon of film, those are those are 5, 6, 7, maybe two hands. You can count those directors' names.
I know. I can't tell you how often I've had a filmmaker in my practice who struggled to get the script right, struggled to get the kind of cast that he wants, struggled with the changes and edits that the studio has done, and it's sort of like trying to hold on to your baby as long as possible. And then when it finally comes out into the world, you feel as though it's not exactly the baby that I raised. And you can go two ways with that. You can understand this is the business and I have only as much control as I have. Or you can do what a lot of my patients do, my director patients, which is go, well, I'm no Billy Wilder. Who was I kidding?
Or you could drink
or use drugs, which is a huge issue in my practice. So I think the expectation on a director to know everything and to be the captain of the ship is very, very, very crushing. On the opposite side, and this is where writers will probably go, well, the heck with them. Who cares about them? Directors are credited in a huge way with the success of a film.
Yeah, it's almost a fetish with writers.
And so
this film by credit makes them crazy.
Yeah. And anyone who's ever been involved in film, I mean, I was a screenwriter for 15 years, and I can tell you there is no film by. I mean, this weekend, you know, Iron Man did really, really well. And so, Jon Favreau is going to do very, very well as a director. He can line up the next 5 years' projects. But there's so many elements that go into why a film like Iron Man would do as well as it did, that to just focus on the director as the reason it happened isn't really logical. So the director's problems, I think, is they are both overly validated when the film or TV show – the film rather is a hit, and they're overly crushed and blamed when the film isn't.
You had an interesting slip of the tongue just now where you almost said that the TV show, and then you realized, I think as we both do, that television directors can make a fine living, can live in a nice home, but get about as much respect as elevator operators.
Yeah, they're essentially considered craftsmen for hire, craftsmen and craftswomen for hire. And it's very in television, a lot – when people ask me, gee, are writers happy? I go, well, the least happy writers are screenwriters and the happiest writers are TV writers, because in television, they are the boss. If you're J.J. Abrams or Dick Wolf or Chris Carter or any of these creative writers who create hit television shows, it's your show. The directors come on essentially to serve the script every week. In film – your job as a screenwriter is to serve the director. It's exactly the reverse. The director says, I don't think this scene's working. The writer doesn't get to go, I don't care, that's the way I wrote it. The writer goes, okay, what do we need? What do you want?
Let's talk about actors.
Sure.
What do you think the biggest issue is with actors?
Well, it's stereotypical, I'm afraid, but it's true. There's a crippling insecurity.
I'm astonished.
I know. But it is the truth that for most actors, in my experience, there's a huge deficit in self-regard and self-love, and that they're often shy and often really insecure about their ability to do other things. Most of the actors in my practice, even the most successful ones, always feel that at some point somebody's going to come in and tap them on the shoulder and said, oh my gosh, there's been a terrible mistake. You're not a movie star. There's been a terrible mistake. You've been found out.
And the lack of confidence leaves them uniquely positioned for a life of misery because they can never leave this business.
That's right. And the other thing is the success, the level of focus, you know, where paparazzi are following you around and, you know, people are just always want to be in your entourage and stuff, constantly reinforces you're important, you're great, you're special. And the actor's struggle is to sort of not buy into it such that the crash will be so big if their movie bombs or their series dies or their career takes a dip.
This leads to the obvious question, which is, are these people sick before they even set foot in Hollywood, or are they made sick or sicker by Hollywood when they finally get to you?
Well, I would probably never use a phrase like sick because I don't find
– off.
No, I don't agree. Actually, in my experience before – I mean, I've worked with many different types of people, and I would say there is no actor that is more narcissistic than the head of a law firm or the CEO of a major multinational corporation. It's just that the narcissism is displayed in a different kind of way, in a public kind of way. In Hollywood, most of the people who come to Hollywood, regardless of their aesthetic ambition, most of the time, and this is a huge generality, they are aspiring to a level of success larger than your average person's. So the risk factor is higher, and the regular normal anxiety and insecurity is exacerbated. In other words, a young woman going to get a job as a secretary in a law firm in Dayton, Ohio is going to be anxious at her job interview. A woman going to audition for a TV series that will either make her a working actor or cause her to have to go back and work at Jack in the Box and have her agent go, well, I guess if you can't get a job, I'm not sending you out on any more auditions. The level of anxiety is different because the stakes are so high and the personal meaning for both of them is so different. The young woman who doesn't get the job as a secretary might walk away feeling, God, you know, I'm really And then her parent or loved one goes, try a different place. And then she does. But in Hollywood, when people fail, all their friends and relatives go, look, this business is too tough. You know, the odds are really against you. You're crazy to want to do this anyway. So you not only have to deal with your own insecurities and doubts and sort of get yourself up the next morning for the next job interview, you have to do it withstanding the criticism and doubt of almost everyone in your environment. So I think it's a little unfair to say about people in Hollywood, well, you're more messed up than others. I worked with a group of lawyers one time. I did a therapy group with attorneys. They were about as depressed, anxious, and using substance as any creative people I'd ever worked with.
Coming up after a short break, more with Hollywood screenwriter turned therapist Dennis Palumbo. You're listening to The Business from NPR. You're listening to The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. Hollywood is the town that put the fun back in dysfunctional. As the writer of feature films like My Favorite Year and TV shows like Welcome Back, Kotter, Dennis Palumbo would know. For years, he suffered the very special kind of stresses endured by Hollywood's creative types, naturally with the help of his therapist. Now, as a psychotherapist himself, he's uniquely qualified to let the healing begin for writers, actors, and directors who may seem fragile, neurotic, trifling, demanding, insecure. You get the idea. You said a little while back that, especially with actors, but with a lot of people in the creative field, that the fear is there'll be a knock at the door, a tap on the shoulder. We regret to inform you that you are an enormous fraud.
Yes.
What's that about?
I think it's because from a very young age, when a person says, gee, I'd like to be a writer, I'd like to be an actor or whatever, it seems so grandiose. It seems so elevated. I mean, if you watch Will Smith on screen and you're a kid who says, you know, gee, I want to be a movie star just like him, your fantasy is he or she has something you don't have. You're not enough. I think one of the reasons that people, you know, read self-help books and stuff is that they have this idea that there's a perfectible version of themselves in the future, and that person will be happy and successful and very secure. Most creative people, when they begin having some success, get a kind of validation like they're on Oprah or the paparazzi follow them around or magazines interview them and want to know their position on the environment. But inside themselves, they know they're the same schmuck that, you know, grew up in some small town looking up at a movie screen and wanting to be an actor. And so they see a disconnect between the public approbation and validation and their sense of themselves, which is that they're just this regular, insecure, neurotic slug. And so someone will find that out. The fear is that it will be found out that they are much less than we thought.
In Hollywood, though, it's possible to actually, though, be a fraud and be successful. And I'm not talking about the idea of, oh, I feel like a fraud.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can maybe have one fluke success and dine out on it for 10 years. You could set up project after project after project, not get any of them made. You could write script after script, sell them, but they never see the screen. There is a sense of you're not really – you may be in the guild. You may do these things. You may sell these projects, but you – it's like tantric sex almost. You never get to to the release of the picture.
And it's a lot more fun with tantric sex. I understand what you're saying. Again, I think of the word fraud. I think of someone who has a reward that's not commensurate with what he or she actually did. You have a fluke success, as you said. And I think those, you know, where someone dines out on one thing for 10 years – to me, that's just a function of the fact that life isn't fair. I think if you've written five screenplays and they've gotten to a certain level of development and they don't get made, it's not because you're a fraud. It's because the vagaries of the marketplace have changed.
But it's easy to see yourself that
way. It's easy to see
yourself. I live in a huge house. I drive an expensive car.
Right.
And I have done nothing.
Right. I have a number of screenwriter patients who have made very significant livings and live in a big house and have their kids in private school, and they haven't had a film made in 7 or 8 or 9 years, but they keep getting paid to write and develop screenplays. And you live in this kind of strange netherworld where we're always trying to explain to your relatives what it is you do for a living, because it's very hard for civilians to understand what development is. Most screenplays don't get made into movies. And yet many, many writers every year are paid to develop these screenplays because the studios need to pick and choose from the products available to them as to which films they're going to make. And writers have very little control. Even directors have very little control over that kind of a situation. I mean, look what happened last year or 2 years ago, I guess, at Disney, when suddenly they took their feature development slate that was going to be like 15 or 16 films and they said, no, let's make them 8. They wanted them all to be franchise films like Pirates of the Caribbean. Well, the people whose – the 4 or 5 or 6 films that were in development up until that moment were suddenly not going to get made, not because the makers of those projects were frauds, but because Disney made a business decision that had nothing to do with them.
Not every film can make $1 billion
That's
worldwide.
Right. That's right.
One of the things that's so vexing for people who work in Hollywood is even in success – it has many fathers. And while it's great in that you can work it and say, I am responsible for X or Y, there are so many factors. Even if you look at an unqualified success like Transformers,
right,
$750 million made worldwide. But, you know, was it Michael Bay? Was it the script? Was it the tie-in with General Motors? Was it just that they picked the right weekend date? Was it that, you know, it's probably all those things. But I guess what I'm asking you is, this is a business where it's very hard to point to a concrete, definite answer of this is why it was a success. That has to be unnerving on a grand scale for people.
Oh, it is. There's not a concrete thing you can do. In other words, if you're saying to someone, I'm going to sell you some pasture land here in Florida, and you go there and there's no pasture land, you go, well, there's a fact. That's fraud. There's no pasture land. Hollywood is a place where, as William Goldman says, nobody knows anything. I guarantee you this week there will be many pundits talking about why Iron Man opened as big as it did. They're all right and they're all wrong, because it's always subjective. I mean, if you look at a film like 1941, which was a big comedy failure of about 20 years ago, that script had been all over town and no one liked it. And then Steven Spielberg thought it was funny. So then everyone liked it. And then the film didn't open. And so the reality is, even if you have Steven Spielberg and a bunch of stars, there's no guarantee. By the same token, a film can open with no stars and no buzz and slowly build a tremendous audience. And then there'll be a bunch of theories about why that was true. And then right now, for example, I can tell you from what my patients in my practice tell me, every studio in town is looking for a quirky relationship comedy like Juno. And everybody in town is writing one, and they're going to make a million of them. And whether they succeed or fail will be because of factors over which no one had any control. And I think that feeds the insecurity and uncertainty that people in Hollywood deal with all the time. There is no technique. There is no thing that works, because even if it worked last week for one type of film or television show, very, very similar elements put together for another film or television show does not work. And because of that, people get so crazy, because there's nothing that they can hold on to. You know, human beings think in terms of cause and effect. You know, if you work out, you'll build muscles. If you get all good grades, you'll get to a good school. Cause and effect works everywhere in the universe except in Hollywood. You can have a great script, a great director, a great cast, and release it on exactly the right weekend, and the movie will or will not do business based on factors over which nobody has any control and no one has a clue as to why. That's a recipe for anxiety.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm afraid I didn't realize this. Our time is up for this week. But we'll have more with screenwriter-turned-therapist Dennis Palumbo on next week's session. Show. His new book is From Crime to Crime, Mind-Boggling Tales of Murder and Mystery. And that's the business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney, who is the executive producer of Sydney Abigail Lipman, 7 pounds, 7 ounces. Welcome to the world, kiddo. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The business is produced by KCRW.